This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
John Whitehead is the CEO and founder of the Rutherford Institute, and he joins us about once a month to talk about issues in his perspective from where he sits in his office. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
I haven't seen you in a while. How are you?
Yeah, it's good. How are you doing?
I'm very good. And you have, for folks who may have missed it, I think you mentioned it the last time you were here, you had just recently finished your next book.
That's right.
And so do we have a, is there a working title yet? Is there a...
Yes. It's presently called Why We Should Give a Damn.
Why We Should Give a Damn. I like that.
Yeah. That's good. It's the subtitle is Struggling to Reunite the Politics of Hope. So it's a book about basically what's going on in the country, all the problems I've seen from a civil libertarian point of view. And as my editor says it from Source Books out of New York, he said it's frightening. And then I have hope, a lot of hope chapters in it. And the hope I see is in all, you know, just your average ordinary citizen out there with a picket sign, or people who are protesting, writing the editor of the local newspaper and just saying we don't like what's going on, to calling the White House and disagreeing, people that are getting arrested. And it's like I tell a lot of people, if you're not going to get most of what's going on watching CNN and those kind of channels, you go to the internet and stuff, you'll see that there are a lot of people out there doing a lot of good things, and just multiply that 100 times, because the big news channels are focused on the entertainment items, which is politics is entertainment right now.
Right, right, right.
And so the people out there protesting against the war, the environmentalists, those kind of folks, you just don't hear much about them, but they're out there doing it. So there are a lot of good things happening, but there's... You know, as I open the book up, I say I'm really worried about my beloved country. And I quote John Kennedy and, you know, the hope of the Kennedy years. And Kennedy gave a lot of people hope. And we really need that right now. Our past several presidents don't give us hope anymore to persevere in these tough economic times and, you know, all the surveillance going on, listening to our phone calls. And President Bush is pushing for more of that now. So there's a lot of tough things going on. But I think that... I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist, but I believe, and I'm not a cynic. I'm skeptical about things, but I think that people can make a difference. As long as we believe that and do it, I think we can change things.
You know, we had the Sorensen Institute at UVA. We had our candidate training program this weekend. We do it once a year, where people who want to run for office here in Virginia, we offer a fantastic, what I think is one of the very best candidate training programs in the country. We teach them how to run an ethical, positive, winning campaign. And I gave the sort of
ethics and politics, is that an oxymoron?
It's not where I come from. But I give sort of the wrap-up speech, and one thing I tell them is, you know, I don't care if you win or lose. The very fact that you're stepping forward to get involved makes my democracy stronger for my country, the country that I love. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Green, or Purple. I don't care. Just the fact that you step up and you step forward and you want to get involved makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, Woody Allen made that great statement. He said, 90% of success is showing up. And show up, do it, take a step. Yeah, I think that's the key. And it's more than going to cast a vote. I mean, that's only the first small step. It's what you do beyond that. I mean, if you see something you don't like, in America, it's incumbent upon you to get out there and you don't like it, protest. I mean, I like to – there's one guy on the street corner. I had somebody tell me the other day, what a silly man. He was on the street corner protesting. I said, no, he's a great American. And there's no such thing as a silly person protesting in America.
Yeah.
No matter what it is. I don't care what it is.
You mentioned Kennedy. What are your thoughts today with the big news today in the POTUS 08 world that the Kennedy family as a unit is coming forward and saying, not only do we support Barack Obama, not only are we going to work to see him elected, but we think he carries the torch of what, you know, our father, our brother, John Kennedy, started in the 50s, in the late 50s.
It's a tremendous boost. I don't know what the Clintons are doing right now. Probably cartwheels backwards. But it's, you know, when I heard it yesterday morning, I said, wow, this is huge, because it does. There's a whole generational thing that goes along that my generation, essentially, which was the Kennedy generation. So I think it's very, very powerful.
Yeah. Let's, if we can, turn the page here. We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. You can learn more online at rutherford.org. Can we talk about the recent cover story in The Hook? You were the subject of a story by Lindsey Barnes in The Hook. And folks, you can read it online at readthehook.com. Your reflections and your thoughts now, looking back 10 years on the Jones versus Clinton case, tell us, if you can, what was the first time you heard about Paula Jones? What were you doing, and what were your thoughts? And tell us how that whole thing came into your onto your radar screen.
Well, I had heard about the Paula Jones issue before I decided that we might want to get involved. I just read the Washington Post early September 1997. I think it was September 9th. It was an article by Peter Baker, who's still with the Post. And I became friends with Peter. But the article mentioned that Paula Jones didn't have attorneys. Her attorneys had basically decided they didn't want to represent her anymore. She wasn't willing to settle for the amount that the Clintons were offering, which I think was around $850, the same thing she eventually settled for. And she didn't have lawyers, so she was basically going to give up the case. That's what the article implied. And I went to the office. And if I had read that article today, we might not have gotten involved. So I just went to my office and told one of my paralegals, see if they need a lawyer. I thought it was a neat issue because the issue from the beginning, again, I knew Bill Clinton in college.
You did his very first political interview.
Yeah,
didn't
two-part
you?
Interview for a newspaper there in Arkansas in Fayetteville. And he was just your green. When I went up and asked him that day, I was a student, third-year student. He was taught con law and criminal law, believe it or not. And I went up and said, hey, he knew who I was. I was the big writer for the local underground newspaper, The Grapevine, which everybody read. No one read the campus newspaper or the local newspaper. It was the thing you read. It was like The Hook and newspapers like that in Seville Weekly.
Sure. And what year was this?
That'd be 1973.
73. And this is at University of Arkansas Law
School. University of Arkansas, yeah. He'd just come back from working on the McGovern campaign. And I was, believe it, at that time, I was a Marxist. So I viewed all those people with great skepticism. And so he said, yes. I thought, yeah, this is going to be fun. So he said, I'll give you a call. So he called me, and it was late one night, like 10 o'clock. We met in a bar, a local bar in Fayetteville, and drank beer. And I did my first interview with him on a tape recorder. If I had those tapes today, I threw them away. Because when I left Arkansas, he lost the race. He was running for House of Representatives. It was just stupid to do, but I never thought that Bill Clinton would go on to be president of the United States. He'd lost the first round. Then when I had moved away from Arkansas, graduated from law school there, and saw that he was actually the governor of Arkansas, I went, this is interesting. But, my wife and I went out and had dinner at his small house in the woods. He lived in the woods, nice little home, and nice guy. He changed my mind. I mean, he was a great politician as he is today. He convinced me to support him. I actually edited my interview to please him, essentially.
Really?
Yeah, because he asked a few things he wanted to remove. In those days, I had long hair and I dressed in my army fatigues. I'd just gotten out of the army, and he knew what he was looking at, long-haired radical. And we started talking about drugs, and he said, he thought heroin should be legalized. And I knew he didn't believe that. That was on tape. That was
really, he was just trying to endear himself to you.
Endear himself to me. And the thing was, he asked me to take it out. I took it out because I knew it was incredibly stupid for him to say that anyway. Good journalists will edit. I don't believe in yellow journalism. I don't believe in going out to get people. And I didn't do that. So, but, if I'd have kept those tapes, I mean, they'd been worth a lot of money. I mean, he just talked generally about Bob Dylan. And we talked for hours. It was a two-part interview that I did.
Yeah, in the bar and then at his house? Is that right?
At several meetings in bars and at his house. Yeah. I got to basically know him. He's congenial. I mean, he'd walk into that bar, and I hadn't been to that local bar. That was sort of the establishment kind of places I didn't go to. I remember the first night that he walked in that bar, everybody greeted him, the barmaids, everybody knew Bill Clinton. I said, gee, I thought he was out of town, but how do people know him? It must have been his local bar. But nice guy. I supported him.
In that interview that you did with it, we're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. In this very first political interview you did with a very young green Bill Clinton in 1973.
He was 28 at the time, I think.
28. He had some things to say then in that interview about impeachment of a president, didn't he? Because of what
very
was going
strong
on
that, yeah.
With Nixon.
He said Nixon should be impeached. Yeah, he had no qualms because he, basically went on to do some of the things that Clinton did eventually. But, everybody at that time, Nixon was the devil, to put it bluntly, to most people, especially people like me. And So it was, you know, easy to convince me of that. But the thing was, a man with great charm, yeah. And that's, you know, about all I can say.
And didn't he say, as far as impeachment, that he thought that, you know, he talked about the regular crimes and misdemeanor stuff, but he also thought that reckless behavior in office deserved what grounds for impeachment.
Yeah, you know, I never really agreed with that. When he was impeached, I thought it was really stupid for that. I know that many of your listeners might disagree with that, but I just didn't think that fit the constitutional test. I mean, people do make mistakes, and sex is one area where people are going to lie all the time. So, especially if you're a public figure. But if he had stolen money, you know, and he lied to a federal, of course, but he lied about something that most people would lie about. He shouldn't have lied under oath. No, he's our president. But
right.
Do I think he deserved? I think that was all political. And I said at the time, I came out against it at the time, said very clearly, I thought I didn't agree with that. Even when we were suing him, I didn't think that was right.
Yeah. And when you were suing him, you're working with Paula Jones. Can you remember the first time that you talked to her? Did you call her on the telephone?
It was sometime in September 1997. Yeah, I talked to her and then went down to Little Rock to meet her. And the reason we took the case, it was my decision, as I met with her, and I believed her story, that he had sexually harassed her in a Little Rock hotel. And then when we got into the case and we really started, we had a couple of private detectives that worked for us, and you know, in the big cases you do those things to find out facts, and the more we learned, we knew that we saw that there was a trail there, unfortunately, of those kind of instances. And there was a great book at the time called The Dysfunctional President by a psychiatrist, and I'd recommend that book. It's about Bill Clinton.
Dysfunctional President.
The Dysfunctional President. It's a study of Bill Clinton, and it's a good study of Bill Clinton, as we came to see in the case. He grew up in a very abusive home, alcoholic father. The father beat the mother, and he said basically that was the pattern of a tragic childhood. And Bill Clinton played that out later on. He had trouble telling the truth and those kind of things. But at the time, you know, when he was president, I would say he's not a bad president. I mean, to be honest with you, and some of your listeners will disagree, he's a better president than George Bush has been as far as running the country. I was never really hostile to the president of the United States. Most people that we get involved in lawsuits, I don't really see them as the enemy. I see them as someone who needs to be brought under control. And in the case, the central figure of the Paula Jones case was rule of law. It's that old Bob Dylan song, you know, even the president of the United States must sometimes have to stand naked. And that means that we're all, in the final day before the court or before God, we're all equal. And if the president has to be under the law as well. And I always thought that was the principle of the case.
Go ahead.
But Paula Jones, it was very, very... It was easy to believe Paula Jones. She was uneducated, basically high school graduate from Arkansas, and not intelligent. She did well, you know, in questioning. I was there in the deposition with the president's lawyer when he was asking her questions, and we were, you know, rehabilitating her, you know, when you do with your clients. But when she did the famous drawing of the president's genitals, I mean, I saw all that. And she was reminding me of Annie Oakley. She shot from the hip and said what she thought. And I kept telling the other lawyers to put her on television more because people wanted her. They didn't agree. But when she was on television, she did extremely well. I mean, she came off very well. People like James Carville, whom I lost respect for, were calling her traitor trash. She wasn't that. I mean, you know, she wasn't perfect, but she wasn't, you know, a prostitute and the kind of things they were. But that was the White House spin at the time.
Yeah. And you, in the article in The Hook this week, you talk about how you were being watched and your office was bugged, and yet that didn't come out at the time.
Yeah,
did you just decide? Was it a conscious decision that I'm going to keep that to myself? Or?
Yeah, I never thought of talking to anybody about it, to be honest with you. One morning when we lived in Culpeper, we lived out in the middle of nowhere. I drove out and there was a black van just sitting there staring at us with two guys in short white shirts and, you know, short sleeve shirts and their ties. They just looked me in the eye. And so we thought our phones might, that they were monitored, which is typical in big cases, especially if you're suing the president or some high government official. And so we had a former NSA, National Security Agency, fellow who had his own private business come in and see our phone. He said, sure, yeah, your phones are being listened in on. But he said, you know, you should expect that. And then I asked him about the van and the – And one of our other attorneys saw one in front of his house later on. He said, you're supposed to see the van. That's supposed to intimidate you. It didn't me. I mean, I thought it was funny at the time. I thought, well, what can you do? You know, it's the federal government. What are you going to do?
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. And then you got calls in your office from somebody who gave you the name of Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, I forget. I think it was in October, early November 97. We got a lady called, and she wouldn't give her name. But she said, there's a girl named Monica in the White House, and the president's having relationships with her.
And this is long before it was, you know, before people had heard the name Monica.
And she was, you know, the paralegal took it, questioned her, and asked her, we got a last name, and she wouldn't give a last name. And we basically said, well, there's not much we can do about that one. Then she said, well, it's pretty well known inside the White House. She watched Air Force One in the front row of the president, and they were necking or whatever. And she called back several weeks later and gave the last name, Lewinsky. And at that point, I mean, it took off. We gave a notice of deposition, and I was in Washington, D.C., three stories up in a building, waiting for her to show up to depose her, actually ask her questions. And as I told Lindsey Barnes, it was weird. The window was, you know, I didn't have the blinds closed, and I saw these cranes creeping outside the window, and there was cameras from the TV people.
Looking in the window.
Ken Starr's investigation, special prosecutor, he came in, basically went to the federal judge and blocked it and got an injunction from us interviewing her because he said she was key to his criminal case. And it would have been amazing. Yeah, we were sitting there waiting for her to show up that morning.
Interesting that Ken Starr was hired to look into the land deal and ended up prosecuting him over, you know, oral sex in the
And we were never in favor of that, because what happened was we were basically a civil lawsuit, and then Starr basically was tracking, taking our witnesses, and
yeah, he basically
should have sent him a bill.
The gist of y'all's case, didn't he? I mean,
he took our case, basically gutted our case.
He didn't prosecute him, that whole Rose Law Firm and the land deal. And
no.
Everybody forgot about that. There was nothing there. And
there was more publicity in the Jones case. And he was portrayed as really evil. I don't think he was evil. I just think he's like a host of other people out of Washington that have political objectives. That doesn't make them evil. They may be unbalanced in some things, you know. But the thing was... Starr, I never spoke highly of any of that, because it was, you know, we had a client that had a legitimate claim, we believe, and they eventually settled for the same amount. But the thing was, by that time, her marriage was broken, the law firms had split, she ended up with very little money, you know, and, you know, we lost money on the case, so. It was a loser all the way around. I was the guy arguing, don't settle, don't settle, don't settle. But the law firm we were working with, they were breaking up. And it was very, very expensive, because we worked pro bono for free. You know, only chance we would have of getting any money would be the lawsuit and recovery of attorney fees. And we never got to that point.
Talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Before we go to a break here at the bottom of the hour, and we'll continue this discussion on the other side. But before we do, you know, you fast forward 10 years now, Hillary Clinton's running for office, Bill Clinton's back out making speeches, attacking people politically. What is it you think, as someone who came very close to this, that whole Clinton machine, your thoughts about what maybe most of us don't know? You know, we all think we know the Clintons so well, but what is it you think we don't get about these people?
Well, I can only tell you what I was told. Some of Clinton's attorneys, when we were just in private conversation, they've essentially told us that Hillary ran everything. She's a very, very strong person. But obviously, she could run the White House. There's no doubt about that. And she called the shots. We were told, essentially, that she was the one that didn't want to settle in the summer of 97. If they would have settled then, you never would have heard of Monica Lewinsky. She thought that the whole thing would go away. But it didn't. So she was very, very strong. Bill is not that strong. That's what we were told, okay? And when I knew him, he wasn't that kind of fellow. He was just a nice guy. You kind of liked him, and he was affable. He didn't come across as this strong leader. And not that he's not intelligent. He's a very, very intelligent fellow. And like I say, I thought the Clinton White House, as far as the way they ran the government, I wasn't really opposed to most of the things they were doing.
Yeah. But clearly, she was the power behind the throne, to speak.
That's what we were told by the lawyers on the other side. Yeah, and they had trouble dealing with her, because there were a number of times when they would like to get a settlement and she'd say no. And we went up to the Eighth Circuit on that case, and it looked like from the arguments that the Eighth Circuit was going to make Clinton actually go back to Little Rock and stand trial and call a sitting president, and that's when they decided to settle.
John Whitehead is the CEO and founder of the Rutherford Institute. You can learn more online at rutherford.org. Before we leave this, 10 years down the road from this, we were talking during the break how you were really at the epicenter of this historical moment that most of us, John, we watched from the bleachers. You know, we would turn on the TV and it was just never ending. Paula Jones, Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky. And you were the guy literally at the center of the storm doing all the media interviews and the going up to D.C. for the depositions and just really must have been exhausting, you know, physically and mentally.
It was exhausting, but the thing I said during the time was that the why we were able to survive during the time was the press. The press was basically, I felt, very, very good. The questions were generally honest, except for a few people. The reporters were great, New York Times, Washington Post, Daily Progress, Bob Gibson. There were a lot of good questions, and there wasn't a lot of, just out to get you kind of attitude. Larry King was great, one of the best interviewers. I was on Larry King 4 or 5 times, always very, very fair. Most of them were very concerned about what was going on in the Clinton White House.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of what's going on in the Clinton White House, there is a possibility here in America that we could have another Clinton White House. What are your thoughts on that, on this possibility that we may see Hillary as president and Bill Clinton, walking around in the background?
Yeah, I'm not anti-Hillary, so I wouldn't take a stand on that. But what we always thought, and this is from, in a case for 2.5 years, that Bill needed psychological help. And as I say in the article in The Hook, he had the tendency to take any kind of favorable actions from a woman as a come-on. And I was asked by Lindsey Barnes why Clinton had so many escapades. Supposedly, a lot of women came forward. Jennifer Flowers, Juanita Brock. There's a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, you were getting calls at your office nonstop from women.
Even during the case, people were indicating there were some problems out there. It's just he takes any kind of favorable action from a woman as a come on, and why they come across his radar screen. It's not that he seeks them out. He's a very powerful man.
Yeah,
and I think that if he's not gotten help in the White House, he could become a liability for Hillary. Maybe he has gotten help. I just don't know.
Yeah. Some would say he already is. Even on the campaign trail, he's become a liability with his comments recently about, comparing Barack Obama to Jesse Jackson, and sort of like his win in South Carolina is just it's sort of like, yeah, Jesse Jackson won South Carolina, no big deal. That really backfired for the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, I thought it came off very negative, and it has backfired. But, the Clintons are aggressive politically, and that's what politics is about.
Yeah. We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Let us now, if we can, turn the page, talk about some of your recent commentaries, which appear in publications around the country, and you can read them, folks, online at rutherford.org. There is,
by the way, I brought some pocket constitutions if people want.
That's right. Thank you for reminding me. 977-1070 is the phone number here in studio. If you've got a question or a comment for John Whitehead, we'd love for you to join the conversation at any time, folks. You know how it works. We also have some pocket constitutions. It's a publication of the Rutherford Institute with an introduction by John Whitehead. Plenty of articles in here, much more than just the written the words of our Constitution. There's a whole lot in here, and we have them free if you would like one at 977-1070. Just give us a call. Let Michael know that you want one. John, what is the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007? That's a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a law that was recently passed in the U.S. House of Representatives by a vote of 404-6. And what it does, it basically points to governmental bodies that will serve as investigation units that will find out what if we have any homegrown terrorists. That's basically the terminology used. But if people would go to the website, rutherford.org, you can read my article. It's called Are You a Homegrown Terrorist? It's a detailed article. But what this law would do is that if you advance political, religious, or social change, if that's one of your goals, if you disagree with the government, you could be investigated. It's much like, reminds me of the McCarthy era, when people would, they were allegedly communist and they were investigated. If you use force or intimidation or coerce others in terms of change. Now, that's protesting at a outside, maybe you're protesting a local supermarket or someone in town because they're not unionized or unfair wages, that could be interpreted as being coercing people. So what this law basically does, it brings everybody, anybody that advocates change or whatever, under the purview of the federal government, not only to be investigated, which they could be, and called before Congress, much like the McCarthy era. And I think it'd be a disastrous, obviously, for the government to do this, but it looks like it's moving in that direction. Also, the Senate version of the bill unites all the federal agencies, FBI, Central Intelligence, with the local police. So you basically have a standing army created, something the Founding Fathers opposed. So they're all linked together in a computer base and will work together. So it's one of, besides a few other things that have come out of the Bush administration, this is one of the scariest things in terms of free speech. But we've seen this in history before with the Alien Sedition Acts early in our history and stuff, when people were jailed for criticizing the government. And that again, this kind of bill would allow the government to do that.
Now, what do you say to the folks, and there's some listening, who say, well, you know, John Whitehead, we have terrorists, and they kill people in this country. They kill Americans abroad. They kill anybody that stands up for freedom. Maybe this is just a tool we need to fight them.
Yeah, I think these properly drafted laws, the problem with these laws is there's no definitions of what it means to coerce, intimidate, or to advocate religious or political change. If they defined it clearly and said it's to, you know, terrorism, they don't do that, it leaves it wide open for some government bureaucrat to tap your phone. That's the problem. But here's the other thing we found out when we researched this, is that this was lobbied for by the Rand Corporation. People remember the Rand Corporation. It was Daniel Ellsberg released, you know, the
Pentagon papers
yeah. from the Rand Corporation. In 2005, they did a study called Trends in Terrorism, where they talk about homegrown terrorism. And this is what we really think it's aimed at, this particular law. They said that, this is a quote, they say that anti-globalists and radical environments who challenge the intrinsic qualities of capitalism are basically homegrown terrorists. Now, let me read that again. Anti-globalists and radical environmentalists who challenge the intrinsic qualities of capitalism are homegrown terrorists. So you're talking about your average, the people that shop at Whole Foods that don't, you know, that are you know, may want to get out and picket against the environment or fight.
So
big
PETA, tree fight, huggers.
They're all falling into this.
If you give
yeah.
money to them, or if you go out and hold up a sign for them, you don't have to let animals out of a lab or burn anything
down. No, you can advocate. You're advocating.
You could just support them in any way, and you could be investigated.
Yeah, but you're talking about people who are concerned about the environment. They don't like globalization. They don't like sweatshops or whatever. They would fall. So we think this is really basically coming out of a lobbying campaign by large multi-corporations like Rand. But here's the key to all this. America's based on dissent. The people forget this country started with a revolution. The colonists were considered terrorists by the British.
Yeah. This country was created by people who overthrew a government.
Yeah, and you have people like the fellow at Monticello saying you need a revolution every 20 years, and the Tree of Liberty was fertilized with
the blood of tyrants.
Blood of tyrants. Today, Thomas Jefferson would have his phone tapped. He would be considered, under this act, a homegrown terrorist. That's why I title it, Are You a Homegrown Terrorist? Anybody that really wants to get out and do something will fall under surveillance by the government, and that's what it's intended to do.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. Another, what's going on with something to do with churches and folks who go to churches to watch the Super Bowl?
Yeah, we were contacted by some churches last year who wanted to watch the Super Bowl in their church, and a couple of the coaches were Christians, and instead of watching the halftime show, whatever was going on there, the churches would hear testimonies from these fellows, and some of the churches advertised as a Super Bowl party, and they asked for a dollar donation, whatever, to pay for the lights or whatever, and watch it on a big screen. NFL came down really hard because there's a copyright law that the NFL actually advocated through Congress and lobbied for. You can only you can't call it a Super Bowl party. You can't charge, and you have to watch on a 55-inch screen.
So the NFL won't let you call your party a Super Bowl party.
You can't call it a Super Bowl party. So what happens is a church contacted us last year, and I wrote to the NFL and said, it looks like we got a lawsuit. And it was a threat letter, but I knew the church didn't know what they want to go ahead or not. But the lead counsel for the NFL called me from the Super Bowl. He was really upset because he thought, what a bad publicity thing. And he said, well, okay, here's what we'll do. They can do the other things as long as they watch it on a 55-inch screen. I said to him, I said, are you going to pass out binoculars? If you have 200 people in church, yeah. 55, you get So they're still adamant. And, you know, we have some churches now contacting us, but it's the same. It's an outdated law. I mean, that law was advocated 10 or 15 years ago. People have big screens these days.
And yeah, yeah.
What it boils down to, though, is they want people in bars or in their homes where you'll watch the commercials. That's what it's all about, ad revenue. But I think it's an interesting copyright free speech case.
We're talking with John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Gary's on line one in Albemarle. Gary, you're on with John Whitehead. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks, Coy. John, I'd be curious to know your recommendation of, say, five or six of the national media outlets that you think are really digging in to issues that should concern us, whether they be, you know, internet sites or newspapers or radio or TV. I'd just like to hear, you know, maybe the ones that you read, the ones you rely on, and talk a little bit about why you prefer those. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for the call.
Well, right off the top of my head, I'd say the Rutherford Institute website at rutherford.org is a good one, because we put a lot of different articles up. And there's a group called Truth Out, which is to the left, truthout.org, I think, is, and they post a lot of articles. It's good, and you get a different perspective. There's a show on public access TV called democracynow.org. I don't always agree with it, but they give you an alternative viewpoint to CNN and, you know,
MSNBC, Fox.
You know, those shows and, like that, where you don't really.
They're all pretty much the same.
But here's what I recommend. You know, and, you know, the internet's full of a lot of neat sites. You have to make sure that you're not getting urban myths sometimes. I mean, I'll get emails saying that, you know, someone's taking over the world tomorrow, you know, and you know, we look at them. Of course, it's not true. But I tell people, look at a lot of different sites. Look at our site, look at Truth Out, look at Democracy Now, watch CNN. In my new book coming out, I got a whole section on the media, and I think most people like it that are just trustful of the media. But I show really clearly how all the major media are owned by huge multi-corporations which donate to campaigns. And you just have to take everything with a grain of salt. Get your news from many, many, many outlets.
That's really the best advice in the end. Yeah. There's not one alternative.
Read good local newspapers like the newspapers in this town. And you're going to get a different slant here and there. The New York Times, of course, is a great newspaper. The Washington Post. Just try to read as much as possible before you make a decision on what you believe. But like I say, with protests and dissents, there's a lot of people out there protesting that you never hear about because the major media does not tell you about it. But the little shows like democracynow.org will give you that. And they're on, you know, they have a website that's quite good.
Right, right.
And you'll get some alternative news. Alternative news is very important in this country right now. Read good books.
One thing I say to Sorensen students is, you know, keep your beliefs. Your beliefs are yours, and I totally respect that. But you should be reading the alternative so you know the arguments they're making and you can understand them. Because I think
you might be wrong.
Well, you could be, but I mean, that's not the reason that I would have somebody do it. I think you should be able to argue both sides of an issue convincingly. As an American, I think you should really don't just surround yourself in a bubble constantly with people that you agree with. You need to sort of branch out and understand where people are coming from, right or left.
You know, industrialized nations, the United States ranks in the bottom 10. We don't read anymore. Yeah, so I tell people, read. That's the only way you can stay on top of things. Nat Hinhoff, the National Syndicated Columnist for the Village Voice.
Yeah.
You know, Nat and I talk occasionally, and he said, "Geez, hey John, I can't keep up with it." You know, he's really out of Harvard, bright guy. And I tell him the same thing. We kind of cross-pollinate each other. But the thing is, he reads all the time, I read all the time, and then we compare notes. But that's the only way you can do it, I think.
I'd also suggest Project Censored does a really good job annually with stories that didn't get much attention in the year before, and it's a real eye-opener. Let's go to Betty online, too. Betty's in Charlottesville. You're on with John Whitehead. Go right ahead.
Yes, hi, thanks. My question is, with these elections coming up, I feel like there's so many sound bites that become kind of factual just because they get repeated so many times, and I'm frustrated. And I get emails from people about this candidate or that. And I want to know a place myself where I can really fact check this information that's being put out. And I know there is a site, or I remember somewhere there used to be a site called Fact Check.
Factcheck.org,
I think
it is.
But is that nonpartisan? I mean, I'd like to know a site that's really not connected with any political party, but is really funded as a nonpartisan nonprofit, kind of nonpartisan.
Watchdog group.
Yeah.
What's it called? Yeah.
A watchdog group.
I think one site that I use a lot is called sourcewatch.org.
Sourcewatch.org.
Yeah, and it's a project for the Center for Media and Democracy. And I often will go there. If I hear the name of a group, I'll go there. And it's sort of a Wikipedia setup. You can go there and just enter the name, and they'll tell you who this group is and who funds it and if they have a slant, that kind of thing.
Because don't you agree that, I mean, I just think it's going to be so important. You know, what happened in the last election with that whole Swift boat thing, and there were just so many fabrications that people took as factual. And I just feel America has got to get a grip and really... this time elect a really good president.
Yeah, and I would say this, and I've seen a president up close and his spin machine. And I'm being skeptical, not cynical here, and I think we need to be skeptical. The image you see of any major candidate is the image they want you to see. They hire experts to present them in the right way. And I've been told this a number of times, and I've actually, you know, worked with people on the Hill, lobbyists, who tell me if a politician says, good morning to you in the morning, there is a political reason for doing so. So it's just difficult to get in power. And always remember the old maxim, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But I always say, really, power just corrupts, period, most people. Yeah. And so we just have to – it's a great song by The Who, Meet the New Boss, He's the Same as the Old Boss. I forget what song this, but it's a great song, great line.
Yeah.
But you know, we've been so many times we've been fooled by these politicians, and we just need to be skeptical. And again, I agree with you. What we need now is a great diplomat, not someone. If Bush goes overseas, they're waiting with him, guns and rakes and slingshots. You know, we need a president who can go overseas and make friends with the world.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson said that if free government is founded in jealousy, not in confidence, that we do harm to ourselves and we do harm to liberty if we have confidence in our elected officials. You're supposed to be jealous of any power that they have.
James Madison said, mistrust all those in power.
John Whitehead is the founder and CEO of the Rutherford Institute, online at rutherford.org. It's always an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.